want to talk today about the unity of God's Word, the Bible, and ask a few questions. Why is it that today we still have the concept that there were two Bibles? One is the Old Testament and one's the New Testament. Why do we still have the concept, and it still persists, that somehow the God of the Old Testament is different from the God of the New Testament? These ideas, these concepts persist, that there were even two Gospels. Somehow the Gospel of the Old Testament was different from the Gospel that you read about in the New Testament. Or maybe sometimes we may know that's not true, but some concepts still get ingrained in our brain some way that, in quote, it's more holy to read the New Testament than it is to read the Old Testament, right? Or that it's more spiritual to read the New than it is the Old. Where did some of those ideas first get started? Why do they still persist throughout the world today? And did Christ come to proclaim a new gospel, or was he the fulfillment of the prophecies in the Old Testament? What was his mission? What was his goal? And what is the inspired Word of God? So today I want to just take some time to show the source of many of these wrong concepts that persist to our day, and where some of these false concepts remain in reality, or sometimes just in attitudes that we might even sometimes allow ourselves to get into. The bottom line of what I want to get across today is that there is one God, there is one Bible, and there is one message from Genesis to Revelation. One Bible, one message, and the message of that Bible is salvation, of bringing sons and daughters into the family of God. It starts in Genesis, and it goes all the way through the last chapter of the book of Revelation. But, some way, where did we wind up with a divided book, you know, that ends with the book of Malachi, and then suddenly you pick up in the book of Matthew? Where did all of these things happen? So I want to basically break the sermon down into three main points today. We will spend a little bit of time discussing, and I'm not going to be able to cover it thoroughly in every way. But the first point will be the gospel according to Marcion. The gospel according to Marcion. Well, you might say, who's he? Well, we'll let you know who he is. The second part will be the unity of the Bible. And the third point will be ways in which the Old and the New Testament complement each other. That there's a theme throughout the book. The same message that is being proclaimed. So our first point I'd like to just take a little bit of time on is Marcion and his concept of what the Bible was and is and why it is divided. I'm not going to be able to cover everything about Marcion. If you want to look up a lot more, you can go on the internet. There's a lot on there. But he was really one of the first individuals in history that began to veer away from the basic concepts of the 12 apostles and the disciples and the church of God. He was born in Asia Minor, in about 85 CE, that is Common Era, of after Christ coming. So about 85, which would have only been a few years after the destruction of Jerusalem and after the fall of Jerusalem and the destruction of the temple, that he would have been a young person at the time when John the Apostle was still alive, and perhaps some of the other disciples when he was a young child. Now, the main source of information about Marcion and his life are Tertullian, Irenaeus, Hippolytus, the Jewish writer Celsus, and there were a couple of others who gave information primarily from his detractors. It's where we usually learn world history and church history, isn't it? From those who are against what's going on. And he had a couple of major works. One was his own translation of the Bible, and the other one was a work called Antipathies, that he showed, according to his understanding and his knowledge, that Christ came to do away with all the things that were previous to his coming. It's not a new concept, is it, right? It was carried on. So Marcion, that's M-A-R-C-I-O-N, M-A-R-C-I-O-N, was born in a, in quote, Christian family in about 85 CE in Sinope, which is in Asia Minor, just off of the Black Sea. And his father actually was a bishop in the area of, he was bishop of Sinope in Asia Minor. Marcion became a very wealthy man. He was a merchant, and he was a ship owner and a shipbuilder who became very wealthy. But he had some problems. Number one, in his childhood, he was accused of various things and was actually excommunicated by his own father from the church. Later, he did not have success in making the church change their ideas and change their understanding and their concepts. It says, Marcion's teachings departed from traditional Christianity in a number of ways. Most dramatically, perhaps, was that Marcion rejected the idea that the Old Testament God and the New Testament God were the same being. So the number one foundational concept that Marcion had was that there are two gods, one for the Old Testament and one in the New Testament. And he had some pretty harsh things to say about the one in the Old Testament, that he didn't like that guy. Perhaps it had to do with him being excommunicated, for one thing. So he rejected the idea that the Old Testament and the New Testament gods were the same. He also believed that Christ came to do away with the Old Testament and God. I'll just read a little bit about his life and what he says from some other sources of information. It says, undeterred, according to one Bible scholar, it says, Marcion embraced a radical polymist theology. We don't know how far developed this theology was at the time of his excommunication, but we do know that it was fully developed by 144 CE. So by basically around 150, he had come to his deep convictions and his total belief that the God of the Old Testament was not the God he served. And so, following his excommunication, then he traveled to Rome. Well, first of all, he went to Asia Minor, to Ephesus and Smyrna and to Hierapolis and to other places, and encountered a fellow by the name of Polycarp. You know who Polycarp was, right? Well, Polycarp, when he encountered this man, he had this retort, quote, "I recognize you as the firstborn of Satan." And that was Polycarp's reaction to this guy, that he was influenced deeply by Satan and by his thinking. But undeterred then by his rejection in Asia Minor, Marcion traveled to Rome on his own ship with a great plan in mind, and that he wanted to change how people thought about religion. So he went to Rome around 137 CE. And in order to try to influence how the church thought about him, he contributed a huge donation of 200,000 sesterces, which was a lot of money that he contributed to the church in Rome. But apparently he had learned a little bit from his lesson in Asia Minor that, well, I'm going to have to do a little bit more to present this so that they will not reject it. So he went into a 5-year study program, rewriting the Bible and rewriting his own edition and translation of it, and also writing his book, Antitheses. And finally, after 5 years of that study, he gathered all of the Roman community and submitted his theology and demanded a verdict from the presbyters in 144 CE. And so he presented his ideas, and he was for the third time rejected, and he was expelled from the community, and he was branded as a heretic. And he also had had his 200,000 sesterces refunded and given back to him. Which, by the way, he takes that 200,000 sesterces and uses it now to publish his false doctrine and his false message. And so he begins his missionary process of trying to influence how the church thought. And so since Asia Minor did not accept him, Rome did not accept him, what would you expect him to do? He started his own church. Okay. Sound familiar? He started his own church since nobody else would do it. And they would not accept what he was teaching. And so in 150 CE, Justin Martyr wrote about this man, and there is Marcion, a man of Pontus, who is even at this day alive, and he, by the aid of the devils, has caused many of every nation to speak blasphemies. And that comes from Justin Martyr, one of the church fathers. Another one of the church fathers, Tertullian, echoed these sentiments. And he said, Marcionism has filled the whole world. And Epiphanius said, the sect is still to be found even now in Rome and Italy, Egypt, Palestine, Arabia, Syria, Cyprus, Persia, and other places. So Marcion lived no more than 15 years after his Roman expulsion, but his efforts influenced Christendom for centuries. So he had a great effect In fact, he had such a great effect that it was after Marcion came on the scene that the church realized they needed to canonize differing parts of so that they would have a Bible and an authoritative view of, which was to a large degree came about because of this false teaching. So what was Marcionism? And it rested on two basic assumptions. One, the first assumption was that Paul's writings were the epitome of what's right. Okay. Paul was the man who had the truth. And so in order to try to prove that, he would quote Galatians, where it says, "I am astonished that you are so quickly deserting the one who called you into the grace of Christ and are turning to a different gospel. Not that there is another gospel, but there are some who are confusing you and want to pervert the gospel of Christ." These are the words of Paul in Galatians. "But even if we or an angel from heaven should proclaim to you a gospel contrary to what we proclaimed to you, let that one be accursed. As we have said before, so now I repeat to you, if anyone proclaims to you a gospel contrary to what you received, let him be accursed. For I want you to know, brothers and sisters, that the gospel that was proclaimed to me is not of human origin. For I did not receive it from a human source, nor was I taught it, but I received it through a revelation of Jesus Christ." Marcion interpreted Paul's words literally that there was only one gospel, not four. And he did not accept then the four gospel writers. He thought Paul was literally the gospel narrative that we ought to believe in. The second assumption is that the Old Testament God was starkly different from the one in the New Testament and from Christ. And he tried to prove that by quoting a couple of different things. Remember the account of the bears in the days of Elisha, right? And that the bears went out and destroyed these boys. That can't be the God we worship, right? And so he used that in contrast with what was said in the book of Matthew about them bringing infants to him that he might touch them. And so from these verses, Marcion made a relatively logical conclusion that the God of the Old Testament, he calls the Creator God, okay, was different to the good God who was the Father of Christ. So that Old Testament God that he called the Creator God was different from the good God that was the Father of Christ. And he went even on to say that in opposition to the good God, the lawgiver, a judge, just, petty, cruel, finite, warlike, jealous, bloodthirsty, severe, fierce, hostile to Christ, responsible for procreation and all other evils of the flesh. That was the summation of what he thought. So in summary, Marcion was foundationally based upon Paul's gospel and the rejection of the Old Testament, and that the Creator God was not in favor with the new good God. And so from that foundation, then he began to spread his other conspiracy theories that Judaism corrupted the true gospel. And the whole problem with all of it was the Jews, right? They did it. And therefore, in his translation of the Bible, he de-Judaizes all of the Bible. And anything good to say about any of them, he took out. Even in Paul's writings, he excised anything that was said the good about the Jews, or that Christianity came into being following Judaism, and that the two are, you know, working together. And so Marcion then purported that to be Jewish and yet exhibit a connection with the Old Testament is false, and it is forged. And to rectify this alleged travesty, Marcion set about restoring the Pauline texts, excising them to form the first closed canon, the Marcionite Bible. And he excised a Bible contained one unnamed authentic gospel, and that was Luke. And so he took away all of the concept of Jewish preceding the New Testament. And so on Judaism, Marcion saw the Old Testament as a book of literal history, rejected it, and did not believe in it. And he always quoted the verse, or the statement, that no one puts new wine in old wineskins. Well, I'm not going down to some of the other beliefs. He did not believe in marriage. He did not believe in eating meat. He did not believe in a lot of other, he did not believe in the virgin birth. He did not believe in a lot of things. But it's amazing how much influence he had. Most of all, in this concept of the New Testament superseding the Old Testament, and that the Old Testament talked about a false God, a lesser God, and that this new God in the New Testament was superior to, end quote, superior to the God of the Old Testament in many ways. And so Marcion taught that the God of the Old Testament was not the God of the New Testament. The God of the Old Testament was the creating God, but he was harsh and cruel. And he goes on down and he says, in other words, while the creating God of the Old Testament was preparing to send a Messiah that would establish an earthly kingdom, the new God acted more quickly by sending Jesus to teach love and mercy for all. In other words, this God of the New Testament jumped in there before the God of the Old Testament could accomplish what he wanted to do. And he goes on, he says, there would be no judgment, no bodily resurrection, no second coming of Jesus. And the purpose of Jesus was to free people from the bondage of the Jewish God. Did you know that's why Christ came? In order to free people from the bondage of the Jewish God and not from the bonds of sinful nature. And so because of his heresies, actually, they had to begin to think about it. What do we really have? Why do we have a canonized, authoritative book that tells us, as a church, what we should believe? And so the canonization of the Bible actually followed fairly quickly after this period of time. And unfortunately, some of the attitudes of division crept into some of those things. Sometimes, even statements that we make kind of make you wonder, are we sure that the Bible is a unity? Is it a unit? Does it carry the same message from beginning to end? So enough about Marcion. If you want to know more about him, you can look him up. He was not a nice guy. He did not believe in the God of the Old Testament, and made that very clear. So now let's talk about the unity of the Bible. That do we then view the Bible as a whole? that we have to be able to see that progression of the plan of salvation from beginning to end, and that we have to be able to work in understanding what God says based upon Isaiah chapter 28 in verse 9 through 12. Chapter 28, verses 9 to 12. Whom shall he teach knowledge, and whom shall he make to understand doctrine? Them that are weaned from the milk and drawn from the breast. That we have grown up, matured. And then it gives this famous concept that for precept must be upon precept, precept upon precept, line upon line, line upon line, here a little and there a little. That you got to be able to put the Bible together. There's an interesting statement in the New Testament, I won't turn there right now, but it says that we have to be able to take a little from the old and some from the new and put it together, that it has a common theme or a common denominator. So we have to recognize how the Bible then is woven together and put together, and how it is a unit all the way through. So in studying the Bible, I would like us to think about the five levels of knowledge that we can use to understand where we're going. The first one is that we remember what we have already learned previously. So you call that remembering prior knowledge. The second part is that we grasp the meaning of the material. There is such a thing as being able to read and not understand, by the way, right? Remember when we were in classes, when we were in school, how you had comprehension, that you could read something and comprehend what it says, and other people could read that and not comprehend it at all? That's the way I was with poetry, right? I could read it, and then that literature teacher would say, well, now do you understand what you just read? No. But much of it didn't make sense, did it? Didn't make sense. But there is a way of reading and comprehending. And that's the second major part of, or the second level of knowledge, is to be able to read and grasp the meaning of the material. The fourth way is, or the third way, is application. Application. That you learn the material by being in the situations. Learning by experience, in other words. And the fourth one is analysis, which is understanding the strategy of why things are the way they are, a strategy for solving problems. And the fifth part of knowledge is to be able to synthesize that knowledge into a logical way of life. Now, that applies to all of us in the church, too. And so, thinking about that from our perspective as members, that we must remember things we've learned, we must grasp the meaning of the material that we are reading and understand it, we need to apply it into our lives, we need to be able to analyze it analytically, and we then need to be able to synthesize it and be able to put it into our life and understand it. And so in the unity of the Bible, we have to recognize that it was inspired of God, that it was God's word. And I'm not going to take a lot of time, but in 2 Timothy, we've all read this before. But Paul makes it pretty clear, by the way, in 2 Timothy, chapter 3, that the Old Testament was inspired by God when he said in verse 16 and 17, that all Scripture is given by the inspiration of God, or literally, as that word means, by being God-breathed, and it is profitable for doctrine, for reproof, or conviction, by the way, or for correction, for instruction in righteousness, that the man of God may be perfect, thoroughly furnished unto all good works. So Paul tells Timothy these Old Testament manuscripts are God-breathed, that they are given for many reasons, least of which is they are given for knowledge and for reproof and for correction and for instruction. And so the Bible was inspired by God. It's interesting, back in the book of John, chapter 6, another concept in that inspiration of the Bible. But he says in John chapter 6 and verse 63, "What, and if you shall see the Son of Man ascend up where he was," or 63, verse, and then he says, "It is the Spirit that makes alive. The flesh profits nothing, but the words that I speak unto you, they are spirit and they are life." So what Christ was saying was, is that holy things have God in them. This holy book has God in it all the way through. We find back in Hebrews 1 and verse 1 and 2 that Christ had an earthly ministry. And then later, these men, I wrote four different gospels about that message that Christ delivered, called the four gospels. They were inspired. And so we find then that this book, starting from Genesis to Revelation, was revealed of God. Now, what are the four ways in which these things are understood? How do we understand the Bible? Number one, you understand it through your five senses. That's called empirical understanding, through the five senses, right? The second way we understand the message of God is experiential, by experience, which, by the way, is not always the best way, right? The third way we understand the Bible is by rational knowledge, or our rational mental ability to deduce or induce certain knowledge and understanding. And so we have to use all of those. But then we also know there is a fourth method of understanding the Bible, and that is called revelation. All right? That God reveals the truth, and he reveals what is going on. We find out back in the book of 1 Corinthians, in 1 Corinthians, I think it's 2 Corinthians, chapter 2. Well, maybe it is 1 Corinthians 2 and 9. Sorry about that. I was using these notes and I quickly wrote it down. Yeah, chapter 2 and verse 9. Where it says, "But as it is written, eye has not seen, nor has it ear heard, neither has it entered into the hearts of man the things which God has prepared for them that love him. But God has revealed them unto us by his Spirit, for the Spirit searches all things, yes, even the deep things of God. For to what man knows the things of a man except by the spirit of man which is in him? Even so, the things of God no man knows but by the Spirit of God. And so this fourth area of knowledge is through revelation. That we cannot understand everything in the Bible except that it be revealed to us. So no matter how many degrees you might have after your name, which is interesting that there is a concept that some way or the other God, when he inspired the Bible, that it was inspired, this is called plenary inspiration, by the way. You won't remember that name, but what it means is that God inspired the Bible word by word. In other words, every word was somehow inspired in its original language and advice in every way, that it was inspired of God. That is called plenary inspiration, that some way or the other, God inspired that. Which, by the way, then makes it totally non-translatable. If that were true, that every word must be the exact word that God inspired, you cannot then, in quote, translate it into other languages. It would be non-translatable. It would be non-producible to other peoples. And yet we know that God's plan for humanity is that all nations were to understand the truth eventually. And so based upon this plenary inspiration, you come up with a whole lot of things, and a lot of people actually put a lot of emphasis upon. In fact, there are whole translations based upon numerical understanding of the word, right? That there is a numerical key to it, or there is a Bible code. God did not inspire it that way. What he did inspire was the theme of the Bible. And the theme of that Bible is God bringing sons and daughters into his family called salvation. So what is the structure of the Bible? Think of us as an upside down V, an actual V, a pyramid upside down. At the bottom of that pyramid, you're going to have the law of God. Next, on top of that, you're going to have the prophets. And then above that, you're going to have the writings. And then you're going to have the Gospels and the Book of Acts. You're going to have Paul's writings. You're going to have the general epistles. And finally, at the top of this upside-down pyramid, you're going to have the revelation that would be revealed by Christ. And so you have that unity throughout the whole Bible. And it is called the message, the way it was presented, what we have today. And there are many things that show, as point number three, as I was mentioning, the point number three is that there is a complementary theme throughout the books, from the Old Testament to the New Testament. They complement each other. Now, how do they complement each other? Well, there are five basic ways in which the Old Testament and the New Testament complement each other. Number one is through allegory. Number two is through typology. Number three is through the unity of promise and fulfillment. Number four is there is a thematic unity called salvation, I mentioned. And the fifth way is that there is a progressive revelation of God down through time. And so in order to understand much of what's written in the New Testament, you must go back to the Old, right? From an allegorical perspective. And I'm not going to take a lot of time on either any of these, but to think quickly about allegory, which is a story of people, things, or happenings. You got an allegory in Galatians chapter 4 and verse 22 on that involved the days of Abraham, right? That it involves Hagar, it involves Ishmael, it involves all of these people. Now, I pray, ask you, could you understand Galatians 4 without having the Old Testament? Would you really be able to understand that analogy of what God was showing through this life of Abraham and through all of the happenings that had occurred? You would never be able to understand that allegory unless you went to the Old Testament and understood it, which Paul then talks about and reveals more clearly to us. The second is typology, that you have types in the Old Testament that are explained in the New. That Abraham was a type of the Father, or that Sarah was a type of the church, or that Isaac is a type of Christ. You would not understand that either, unless you understand the typology. You find in number 3 is that the unity of promise, that the promise of salvation begins in Genesis chapter 3 and goes all the way through the Old Testament and through the New Testament, the promise of a Messiah. And then you have thematic themes that are developed, such as mercy and judgment. And finally, number 5, you have progressive revelation. In other words, some things that are made in the Old Testament finally come to more thorough understanding in the New. I'm not going to take the time to read some of that, but think of Hosea chapter 1 about Israel being put away and her name being Lo-Ruhamah and Ruami. That you will not understand that unless you also go to the New Testament and find out, well, what was he talking about? And there is a modern day Israel today that God is fulfilling much of what he did in the Old Testament to the nation of Israel, but today it is a spiritual nation that he is working with. And so there is a unity all the way through what God said. And so we find that much of this wrong concept about the Bible, about the gospel, began with Marcion. Much of the concept of being a hard monster God in the old and a loving, kind God in the new started with him. He did not agree with and did not believe in the unity of the Bible. And he did not think that the Bible complemented itself. We were complementary in the old and the new. So it's amazing to me how much influence a man who was branded a heretic, even in the days of about 150 or so CE, how much influence he has had over concepts and ideas in the Christian church. Even though they branded him a heretic and expelled him and excommunicated him, the ideas were not expelled and excommunicated. The ideas were carried on. And we find much of Christianity today, actually, in one way or the other, believe in a lot of the same ideas to one degree or the other. I've mentioned before how one person told me not too long back that she did not believe in the Old Testament. She will not read the Old Testament. She does not believe in that God. And here she was coming to the church. Yeah. But she wouldn't even read it. And so you see how much of that concept has fostered even into our own attitudes sometimes. And that's what we need to think about, is our attitude and belief. Let me say once again at the conclusion. The whole idea of this sermon is to believe, come to the reality that there is one God, there is one Bible, and there is one message for humanity throughout the whole book. And that message is that there is salvation to be put into the very family of God.